Welcome to Rise, an Eastern Standard documentary series about life and times in Eastern Kentucky. Rise is produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Crystal Jones, in for Tom Martin. Thank you for joining us.
These mountains are my home. I've been here all my life. She gives me what I need, and I need not ask her why. Now the river, she's been flowing since before my time. She gives me what I need and takes me down the line. Let it flow on down to the mountainside. The ancient river flowing, she reaches far and wide.
Jackson singer-songwriter Jeremy Short in his song The River tells us about a fixture of his hometown, the North Fork of the Kentucky River. Life along the river can be pleasant, but 1 year ago, on July 27th, 2022, rain began to fall at rates heavier than anyone can remember, forcing the river, as well as creeks and streams, far out of their banks, flooding Jackson and much of the southeast Kentucky region. In this hour, we'll look into the issues that linger 1 year later. I recently reconnected with Mayor Laura Thomas of Jackson, Kentucky, to learn how things have progressed in her home county of Breathitt.
Even though it's been a sad situation, we are making progress, and we're coming up on the 1 year anniversary of the 22 flood. So it's probably an appropriate time to talk about any progress.
The largest challenge faced so far has been the acquisition of land suitable for rebuilding homes.
Unfortunately, people have left Jackson and Breathitt County. We didn't have anywhere to put the displaced people. And that's a common problem throughout the flood-affected areas, that everyone had a housing crisis. Everyone was short housing. But then you compound two major floods, 21 and 22, and that really just made it, beyond a crisis. I don't even know what you would say, but, I mean, it's beyond a crisis. And if people can't find a safe, affordable home here, then they have to find one somewhere.
Disaster relief in the form of a buyback program has provided funds for purchasing and developing new housing, but land outside the floodplain still remains scarce.
You know, they're just kind of a few people own a lot of property that is close to infrastructure. And so we just don't have a lot of property to choose from, or property owners that are willing to sell for a reasonable amount that we could develop housing. I can say that as far as the city buyout project, we had about 42 people sign up for the buyout. FEMA is sending us those projects as they get the, you know, their paperwork completed. And then it's moving slow, especially for the property owners. But at the same time, FEMA and the state say that this is record speed, because we actually were able to buy two properties before the year anniversary of the flooding. So we will continue to work with those property owners just as soon as all of the, you know, the title search and the appraisals and the abatement and all of that work is done. We will continue to work with folks on that. But just as I said before, Crystal, we've got to, once we buy those properties out of the floodplain and get people out of harm's way, we have to have some place that they can either build back or some place for them to rent. And we really want to keep them here in Jackson and Breathitt County.
Housing is a major ongoing concern, although there has been some progress toward development.
Samaritan's Purse purchased the property that's above the Social Security office. It's on a mountaintop. It's a ridge over from King's Ridge. And they have really built a nice road, and they're going to be able to build 14 houses up there. Originally, they had thought maybe up to 20, but then after they built the road and have done some excavation, it looks like they're going to be building about 14 homes. They have their own vetting process, people that they have worked with, you know, throughout the 21 and 22 flooding, and they'll be determining, you know, who they put in those homes. But it's just a super nice development.
Along with housing, other infrastructure will be needed to ensure that families have the resources to remain or return to their home in the county.
And that's part of the recovery process, is not only developing homes, but we're going to have to develop job opportunities for people and have the infrastructure that we need to support housing development and business and industry development. Mm-hmm. So, you know, hopefully with the, you know, long range recovery, that we will make a, you know, just an overall economic impact and develop our community into a place that people will want to come back home to.
As areas recover, material concerns are not the only needs being addressed for survivors. Traumatic events such as the flood can often leave those affected dealing with a number of issues from PTSD to chronic depression. Recovery plans have included outreach programs such as Kentucky River Community Care and FEMA, which continue to provide resources and assistance to those in need.
It was very traumatic, and even people that didn't have home damage, so many of their family or friends were affected by the floods and either homeless or lost all their contents or you know, lost family members. So it's had a huge mental impact on our community. And I can say that, you know, early on from the beginning of the disaster, you know, Kentucky Emergency Management and FEMA recognized that, you know, mental health is a very important issue that needs to be addressed. And to that end, there were numerous grants for mental health agencies that were providing free counseling and mental health services. So definitely, you know, we want the message out there that there's nothing wrong with still feeling depression because of the flooding, and for people to seek help because there are resources out there.
As the week closes, many have plans to gather in remembrance of the lives and livelihoods that were lost during the flood and to remind one another that there is strength in community as East Kentucky continues to recover.
We know it's been a year, but we're never going to forget, and we're going to continue to work hard toward recovery, whatever, you know, how it's going to look different for every person. That recovery process is going to be different. So just for the community to know, hey, we've got each other's back, and we're going to continue to work toward recovery and rebuilding in a smarter, safer way for Jackson and Bertha County.
Jackson Mayor Laura Thomas. The flood of 22 brought destruction and death to 13 counties in southeast Kentucky, with Breathitt, Knott, Perry, and Letcher taking the brunt. 44 lives were lost. And as Mayor Thomas told us, the destruction of housing is still a major issue for many. Tom Martin got an update on the housing situation from Eric Dixon, senior researcher at the Ohio River Valley Institute.
How many homes were destroyed during the flood of 22?
There were about 9,000 homes that were damaged by the flood, and that's according to records from FEMA. Basically, it's based on the number of families that have applied for assistance for damaged housing.
And how many people were living in those homes?
There were about 22,000 people living in those homes.
We know that it's been slow going for the state has been attempting to find locations, and one big problem is the topography of the region, which can really impede this kind of development. Did you all take that into account?
I think one of the reasons that the flooding was so bad is because the topography. And a challenge in rebuilding is also going to be the topography, in that it's going to be difficult to find enough property quickly to develop all these new homes if we indeed go that route. And I think the developments that the governor is pursuing is a good start, you know, in trying to find some flatter property on higher ground. But I think it's going to be very challenging to find all of that quickly in the area where, you know, particularly those four counties that were hardest hit.
We know that something like, I guess, 80% of these homes were not even in floodplains. And that's brought up conversations with engineers and others about the difficulty in even knowing where to build. You know, obviously high ground, but a lot of those higher ground locations are inaccessible. It would be difficult to build a road up the side of a mountain like that. So it's really a daunting problem, isn't it?
It's absolutely daunting. And there's a lot of layers to it. I mean, before the flood, there were already challenges with drinking water and sewage water infrastructure and getting power and broadband. These were public policy challenges that we've been trying to address for years. And this makes it even more difficult. But those challenges remain, and you have county governments that don't have the funds to provide that infrastructure out to those, you know, new developments. So I think it's going to be challenging from an engineering and a funding viewpoint to figure that out.
For homeowner survivors who would like to repair their homes, the affordability issue comes to the forefront. This is not a wealthy region. It's a region of pretty deep poverty, and median incomes are very low. How well can survivors afford repairs?
This is the part of it that I think is most heartbreaking to me, because as we've discussed, we had 9,000 homes damaged basically overnight, with 22,000 people living in those homes. And that could be an underestimate. So with flooding, oftentimes your house insurance doesn't cover flooding. You have to have a separate policy that protects you from flood damage. And what we found is that about 5% of the families who had their homes damaged had a flood insurance policy, which means that the other 95% didn't have insurance to help them out with this. And that means it's going to fall on them to try to find a way to cobble together some kind of money to repair. What we found was that 6 in 10 of the families that have damaged homes made $30,000 or less in income before the flood. Many of those families made significantly less than $30,000. And also, many of those families, probably their work has been interrupted, either because their workplace was destroyed or, you know, they're dealing with a family crisis or a personal emergency related to the flood. So it's very difficult, if not impossible, to see how many of these, if not most of these families, are going to afford repairs. I mean, $30,000 is about how much it costs to repair your house if you had about an inch of water on the first floor. And if that was your situation and you made $30,000, that would leave nothing else to pay for the rest of your expenses for your family for the rest of the year. So it is a very, very heartbreaking situation. And I think it's going to require assistance from the state and the federal level.
What kind of resources are available, like FEMA awards? Do those awards help cover at least some of those repair costs?
They do. FEMA housing assistance awards can be up to $39,000. But even if you got the maximum award, which many of the families did not, it's unlikely to pay for all of your repairs. As of the beginning of this year, when we calculated these, the median housing assistance award from FEMA was about $5,000, which just pales in comparison to the cost to repair for most situations, you know, if your home was damaged by the flood.
Are there other resources available?
There are some resources that are available. One thing that I would encourage families who are impacted to do is to reach out to the nonprofit housing developers in the region, Housing Development Alliance, Homes Incorporated. You could start there. They're doing great work rebuilding homes, but they don't have enough money to rebuild all of the homes that were damaged. So there are some resources through them and through the state's housing agency, but it's going to take more investment on the part of the state government to do that. We saw some proposals in the last legislative session to make a $150 million investment this year and a $150 million investment next year in rural housing across the state. And unfortunately, the legislature did not decide to do that. So I think the basic first step would be to put $150 million in the Rural Housing Trust Fund that the state did create in the last session to try to get more money into development after the flood.
You conclude your report, Eric, by saying that policymakers have an opportunity to take action that could not only repair damage, but ensure that families and communities are protected from future flood risks. And we know that weather is becoming more extreme and it's becoming more unpredictable. What, in your view, are some of those opportunities and potential actions?
One thing I think to consider here is that in 2018, the Kentucky Division of Water released a report acknowledging that future flood costs and risks are likely to increase across the state. So with that in mind, it's absolutely necessary for the state to not only address the housing damage that we have after this flood, but to start thinking about the future, both in terms of how we do the housing rebuild in southeastern Kentucky, but also other policies that can help reduce the risk from flooding in the future. And the Army Corps of Engineers actually released a report that included some very interesting recommendations that could help prevent flooding in the Ohio River Valley. And some of the things that they recommended were expanding ecosystems that serve as buffers for flooding, such as wetlands and native forests. They recommended things like installing retention ponds in areas where you might have a lot of excess runoff to capture that during peak rainfall events. They recommended rehabilitating flood control dams that are in poor, unsatisfactory condition. And I thought this was very interesting, to kind of think about those flood control dams and their schedules, like their release schedules, in light of how the climate might change in the future, in light of basically how rainfall might change throughout the year, and to continually update those release schedules. And they also recommended improving construction techniques that can actually lower flood risk and protect homeowners in the event of a flood. Those are things like low impact development construction techniques. If you're in more of a like urban or suburban setting where incorporating stormwater management could help address the amount of runoff if you have like a lot of pavement in the area. But also things like incorporating what they call wet and dry flood proofing in the design of buildings, you know, as you're building them, as well as elevating structures in light of flood zoning and updated zoning laws that incorporate the latest modeling we have around flood risk.
Eric Dixon mentioned that the nonprofit housing development organizations are now building new homes for flood survivors. Tom spoke with the head of one of those organizations, Scott McReynolds, at the Housing Development Alliance in Hazard.
Thank you for joining us, Scott.
Great to be here.
So it's been a year since the flood destroyed or did severe damage to thousands of homes in southeast Kentucky. Since then, there have been efforts to repair or build new housing for those who lost their homes. How has that gone? What has been accomplished?
How you view that's really interesting. On the one hand, I think the Housing Development Alliance and some of the other nonprofits have done more in the last year than we've ever done. And yet, when compared to the need, it's kind of a small drop in the bucket. So on the one hand, we're really proud of what we've accomplished. My organization has, I think, completed 10 new homes specifically for flood survivors, and we've got about 12 more under construction. And that's in addition to our regular work. So like I say, that's a really good year for us, and that's great. but we also know we're working with over 150 families that want a home.
Has it been a challenge to find new locations that are not prone to flooding?
Yes, and that varies a little bit by counties. I think we've struggled specifically in Breathitt County, and talking with some of our colleagues, I think Letcher County is pretty tough. We've been a little bit fortunate in Perry and Knott County so far. They just have a little more flat land for one reason or another. I'm not sure why, but it definitely is a challenge. So far, I wouldn't, other than like in Breathitt County, I don't think that's been a limiting factor yet. But unless we can find some more property, it probably will be.
Well, you know, Scott, I'd like to get your take on this. It's my understanding that when FEMA completes a buyout, that that property is taken off the market in perpetuity. So it can never be built on again, unless it's like a government park or something. And there are 200 or so FEMA buyouts in Letcher alone, which takes a lot of properties off the market. Has that been an issue for you?
You know, that's not been an issue yet. It certainly long-term, you know, could become, as FEMA buys more property, a little bit challenging. But those properties are in the floodplain and aren't a great spot for a permanent house. So I think the flip side, if those properties aren't permanently restricted, you run the danger that, you know, in the future, somebody could rebuild there, set a trailer there, and then experience the same sort of disaster we've just come from. So I understand it's a little bit of a concern, but it also has a big benefit. The only thing I wonder about is if, you know, in the future, if there's any way we could ever mitigate some of those properties so they could become usable in a way that didn't expose somebody to flood risk, you know, would there be any wiggle room to, and I don't know, but that would be nice if there was some potential to use it again in the future, if it could be done so safely without risk of flooding.
Are there any important lessons that you've learned that you might not have otherwise had this not happen?
You know, one of the positives that I'm continually reminded of is what a great community we live in. I mean, just the response of the community and the state and all the help that's poured in that's been amazing to witness and very uplifting and helping us all get through this challenging time. Another thing that I'm beginning to understand is that when folks go through a disaster, it's such a big thing that they often get kind of fixated on what the next step is. And so we'll have a conversation with somebody and it'll be, if I can just figure out how to get my electric hook back up, I can move back in. And yet when we get to the house, you know, since we're not living that trauma, you know, we can see the house has a lot more needs. And so I think learning how to play that role to helping people see that bigger picture is something we're figuring out how to do. And then ultimately, I think the big lesson is that in a flood, at least, there lands up being this tension between what people might initially want moving back home, what is quickest, again, often moving back home, and then what is ultimately really best long-term, which would, in my opinion, would be for most folks to relocate out of harm's way. You know, and there's a real tension in that, and we as a community kind of have to figure out how we manage that. You know, we can't ask people to live in campers for years and years while we get around to building a bunch of houses.
And also, there was certainly a push to try to relocate people to higher ground, which is much easier said than done, isn't it?
Absolutely. Even once you have the property and there's the governor's high ground communities and then a couple of private initiatives that are happening that involve, you know, developing a subdivision on higher ground that are going to be wonderful when they're done. But even once you've identified the property, it still takes a long time to get water and sewer and roads and electricity up to high ground to build on. Again, how do we keep people housed in a reasonable manner while we wait on these long-term solutions is one of our challenges.
For quite a while there, supply chain issues and inflation were big problems, especially on the pricing end. It seems as though maybe the supply chain is beginning to loosen up again, and we're seeing numbers from the government that show that inflation has kind of softened a little bit. But have those been issues in trying to get these homes built?
Yeah, absolutely. Prices went sky high during the pandemic, and they have come down on some items. but not across the board. And it seems like when something goes down, some other item will go up. PVC piping is especially expensive now. Concrete is very expensive currently. I think it's a little bit better, or maybe we're just used to it, than it was during the kind of the height of the pandemic, but it's still a real challenge. And, you know, when you're looking at having to rebuild hundreds of units, if you're spending an extra $1,000 or $2,000 a unit, and you're going to plan on building 200, 300, 400 units, that gets to real money in a hurry.
You know, it seems you can always find some sort of silver lining in these situations. And I'm just wondering if you all have seen this as an opportunity to change or improve or somehow adjust design of new homes and add perhaps technologies that weren't available in the past.
To a certain extent, I mean, we focus on highly energy efficient homes. We're 100% Energy Star builder. Our new homes use about half the energy that you would expect a typical new home to use. And a lot of the homes that were being replaced were not as energy efficient. And so that is a silver lining. But I think if there is a big silver lining, it's around the fact we had a housing crisis before the flooding event. And I mean, when we left the office on July 27th, 22, we were working with over 500 families that either needed a new home or needed home repair. So we were in crisis before, and this event has brought resources and attention. One of the things with the high ground communities that's being talked about is hopefully they're going to be big enough and have enough lots that, in addition to helping folks who were directly impacted by the flood, they can just be a place where quality units can be built. Maybe when we get to the other side of this, we have a good start on actually not only recovering, but improving the overall housing crisis.
All right. That's Scott McReynolds, Executive Director of the Housing Development Alliance in Hazard. We always enjoy talking with you, Scott, and this is an ongoing situation, so I'm sure we'll darken your door again, if that's okay.
That'd be fine, Tom. It's great to talk to you.
Great to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Other nonprofit groups committed to building new homes and home repairs include the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and Homes, Inc. Funding has been flowing into the region. Most recently, Governor Andy Beshear and Appalachian Regional Commission Federal Co-Chair Gail Manchin announced a $5.3 million funding to pay for water and sewer services to new high ground communities. And there is still more, as Tom Martin learned in conversation with Tom Carew, the USDA's Rural Development State Director in Moorhead.
Welcome back to Eastern Standard, Dr. Carew.
That's good to be with you, Tom. I appreciate the invitation. Thank you.
And if you would, tell us about this federal funding that you and Governor Beshear announced late last month, how much money we're talking about, what it's for, and so forth.
Well, I think the overall amount that the Congress allocated back in December as part of the omnibus funding was, I believe, $325 million. And of course, that's not just for Kentucky, that's for the entire nation. So we need to do our part in Kentucky to get as much of that as we can. It'll be by application that we receive from the individual water and sewer districts across the impacted area. The calendar year 2022 presidential disaster areas in Kentucky, there's somewhere between 25 and 35 counties that are eligible.
Okay, and those counties do include Breathitt, Knott, Letcher, and Perry, which are the four hardest hit in last summer's flooding.
Yes, very much so. Very much so.
What kinds of damages did water systems in those counties incur during that storm?
The overall damage to the water and sewer systems from those disaster areas totals over $1.4 billion worth of damage. Now, that's information I received from the Kentucky Division of Water.
Is that for the total number of counties or just for those four?
That is for Breathitt, Clay, Floyd, Johnson, Leslie, Knott, Letcher, McGoffin, Martin, Owsley, Perry, Pike, Wolf, and Whitley.
Are any communities still without water or are having difficulty providing water to their citizens?
The state of Kentucky, with help from the National Guard, has provided interim systems to either treat sewage or to make sure that folks have adequate water supply. That may mean, and I don't want to misspeak here, but that may mean that the National Guard or contract haulers are hauling water, you know, to certain systems to make sure folks have adequate water.
And some of those communities, Martin County, for example, had been experiencing pretty severe water situations before the storm. So they get to benefit, actually. I guess that's a bit of a silver lining from the flooding.
Yeah, that is a bit of a silver lining. And the issues in Martin County are quite extensive. And from what I understand, many of those issues have to do with the infrastructure that was put in place originally and probably needing to be redesigned in order to correct the water situation in Martin County for the long term. I think it was March or February, my staff met with the governor's staff to make sure that all the water and sewer districts knew that this money was going to be coming available so that they would be ready to apply for it as soon as the window opened. So we're looking forward to those applications and to getting more than our fair share of that money here in Kentucky.
Is it a difficult process to apply? Does your office provide counties with guidance, for example?
We do, and the area development districts, and I think in the majority of cases here, we're talking about the Kentucky River Ad, the Big Sandy Ad, those two ads, Cumberland Valley Ad, are the ones that will be carrying the burden. And they typically work with the water and sewer districts as well as the various engineering firms that are out there. Now, Tom, when you ask that question, you know, is this a difficult process? Typically, in my experience, it takes 2 years to process a water and sewer application because of all the engineering that's involved and the environmental application that needs to be filed and pulling all the other pieces together. So it is a complicated process. It's not a novice, that's for sure. But all of our water and sewer districts have experience with applying for funds, whether it's from USDA or the Kentucky Infrastructure Authority. So most folks have expertise, but that doesn't make it a simple process, Tom. And I've only been on this job for a year and working for the federal government for a year. And maybe it's too trite to say, nothing is simple, but that's the fact.
I've been talking to a number of people about how difficult this must be for infrastructure engineers to figure out how to build sustainable infrastructure that can withstand the unknown effects of climate change that we have no idea what's coming.
You're right, Tom. You know, the floods are more extreme. The tornadoes seem to be more extreme. And that does present challenges for the engineering group that's out there that are designing these systems. And, you know, you've traveled in Eastern Kentucky, you know that most of our roads are along the creek, and that's where we put most of our infrastructure. You know, our electric supply, our telephone supply, our water and sewers generally run along those roads, which are pretty much along the creeks and rivers that we've got. And when we had this kind of devastating flood, the erosion, of course, that occurs is tremendous. And trying to put those lines back in safer areas presents a lot of challenges and costs as well.
All right. That's Tom Carew, USDA's Rural Development State Director for Kentucky. Thank you so much, Tom.
Tom Martin, great to talk with you. Thanks so much and keep up the great work.
We'll be back in a moment. I'm Crystal Jones, and you're listening to Rise, an Eastern Standard documentary series on WEKU.
This is WEKU Arts reporter Sherry Lawson with coming events and artist opportunities provided by the Kentucky Arts Council. Winchester's Leeds Theater will present Matilda the Musical August 18th through the 20th and August 25th through the 27th. For information and to purchase tickets, visit leedscenter.org. The Lexington Art League and Lexington Parks and Recreation will host Woodland Art Fair August 19th and 20th at Scenic Woodland Park in Lexington. For information, visit woodlandartfair.org.
The Kentucky Arts Council is currently taking applications for its Kentucky Crafted program. The deadline to apply is August 15th. Contact Arts Marketing Program Director Dave Blevins at david.blevins@ky.gov for more information. For information on how to support these and other arts events in Kentucky, visit artscouncil.ky.gov. I'm Sherry Lawson. Now back to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
We're back with more on this latest edition of the Eastern Standard documentary series, Rise. I'm Crystal Jones, in for Tom Martin. We've heard about challenges, needs, and funding. As attempts are made to build new homes on higher ground for the thousands who lost theirs to the catastrophic flash flooding that struck southeastern Kentucky 1 year ago. Now we turn to preparing for future extreme weather. More from Eastern Standard's Tom Martin.
As climate change intensifies severe rainstorms, the infrastructure protecting millions of us from flooding faces growing risk of failures, according to a report from First Street Foundation, a nonprofit focused on weather risk research. Jeremy Porter is head of climate implications research at the First Street Foundation, and he joins us from Brooklyn. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Dr. Porter.
Hey, thank you for having me on. I'm looking forward to talking about it.
NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, has acknowledged that its data are outdated by a rapidly changing climate. What in the way it estimates rainfall makes that NOAA data outdated?
Yeah, it's a really interesting issue, and it's one that we dug into as part of this project. But just for context, I mean, we started building our own precipitation estimates as a way of improving our own flood models. We have an internal flood model, a wildfire model, a heat model, and a wind model. And one of the problems that we were having up to this point was we were relying on the NOAA Atlas 14 product. So we went through the process of building a new set of precipitation estimates, building on, as you say, the known issues in the NOAA Atlas 14 precipitation records. And the biggest issue that they have is that when they started to create the NOAA Atlas product back in the 1970s, there was a pretty well sort of understood or accepted way of thinking around the issue that there was not climate change increasing extreme precipitation events. So there was this issue called stationarity, where we actually see precipitation estimates staying pretty constant over time. But as we've moved into the new century, we're actually seeing those precipitation estimates are increasing pretty quickly, and they're increasing sort of unevenly across the country. So the biggest issue associated with the NOAA Atlas 14 precipitation records is that they're not taking into account environmental change, or what's referred to as climate change. And we look at a lot of different records, a lot of different precipitation gauges, a lot of different data points, and you can see that there is this increasing trend in both the likelihood and the severity of extreme precipitation events across the country.
Well, we know that NOAA recently got about $32 million from Congress to update its precipitation standards, but that update isn't expected for years, like 2027. And as we know now, a whole lot can happen in the meantime. Is NOAA struggling to keep up with the increasing intensity of these weather events?
That's a really good question. We should always go back and reference the fact that NOAA has terrific scientists on their side. Some of the best climate scientists in the world are employed by NOAA. NOAA knows that these are issues. The biggest problem is the bureaucratic nature by which the new Atlas program is going to be implemented going through the federal government. The report that we put out, we created estimates that we believe are going to be similar to what NOAA ends up producing when they produce the NOAA Atlas 15 record. And we're not the first researchers to do this. Other researchers have done this as well. So these are known issues. These are things that NOAA knows how to correct for. NOAA could do it quickly. The biggest issue is that when you get that type of federal funding, there's a lot of back and forth in terms of the bureaucracy, in terms of working with external scientists, working with external communities, building these methods and models in a way that generally builds consensus among the larger scientific community and the practical community, the people that are going to be using this information. So they're not having trouble keeping up with the fact that climate change is occurring. There's a lot of bureaucratic hurdles that exist at the federal government level that keep them from being able to act as fast as a research organization like we might be able to.
Right. So you all are free of that kind of bureaucratic red tape and so forth.
Right.
In late June, First Street released a peer-reviewed precipitation model that is more immediate than the NOAA model. It captures climate-driven changes in heavy rainfall events across the country. Tell us what you found.
Yeah, it was really interesting. And as we alluded to earlier, the biggest difference in our model versus NOAA is that the NOAA model doesn't take into account climate change. And the primary reason why that's the case is because NOAA takes these historic observation records. They go back into the 1800s. And when you have that much data, generally from a data science perspective, more data is better. But when you take that much data and you assume that there's no climate change, then essentially you're assuming that the median metric or the kind of the average metric in that pool of data is what's appropriate. But if you look at the trend in these metrics, we've actually seen a lot of increasing, an increasing trend around the likelihood of these extreme precipitation events. And where we're seeing that is uneven spatially. So we're seeing in the Midwest, we're seeing in the Appalachian region, we're seeing in the Northeast, a couple places along the Gulf Coast, and then in the Northwest portion of the U.S., also these dramatic underestimations of severe precipitation events. And overall, from a national level, we see about 51% of the population lives in counties where what NOAA is saying is the 1-in-100-year rainfall rate actually occurs about every 50 years. So it's occurring about twice as likely. And in the most severe of cases, around the Ohio River Valley, right around Louisville, Kentucky, actually, we're finding counties in that area where the 1-in-100-year depth is actually occurring about every 10 years. So we're seeing a tenfold increase in the expectation associated with those severe extreme precipitation events.
What do you see for counties in the Southeast Kentucky region or Eastern Kentucky?
There's a pretty consistent trend in that area. We know there's been floods that have actually recorded above the 1-in-100-year record in recent years. But if you just look at the 1-in-100-year rainfall depth in the NOAA Atlas 14 records, and then you look at them in our model, we're seeing that the increase, a 1-in-100-year event occurs about every 50 years in counties such as Allison County or Leslie County. If you look at Clay County, we actually see less than that, about once every 48 years. So in those areas, we're actually seeing that 1-in-100-year storm is actually occurring about every 50 years, or twice as likely as what we plan for, what we prepare for. And as you move that out into the future, we also projected our models out 30 years to 2053. That's only going to increase. So we're it's not a huge increase. You know, the biggest adjustment is actually getting NOAA data to be current with what our current risk is. But if you project out into the future, it's only going to continue to get worse as we move into the future.
Congress also recently approved the Biden administration's $1.2 trillion plan for capital investment and infrastructure spending through 2027. But are some or many of these projects being built to standards that are already out of date because of this fluid situation that we're in with climate change?
And that's probably the most direct kind of tangible consequence of the NOAA Atlas 14 records not being up to date, and it taking 4 more years to get the updated records that are going to include climate adjustments and are going to include future projections. But we have all of the decades that have preceded this, and at least another 4 years of NOAA Atlas 14 precipitation records being seen as the gold standard in design standards for infrastructure. Most states across the country, their Department of Transportation directly references NOAA Atlas 14 as the primary precipitation product that needs to be used when building roads, for instance. And if you're building roads to a standard that are already out of date, or maybe built to a standard that was the climate in the 1980s, all of a sudden the useful life of those roads not only wears down in regard to the amount of times that they get flooded, people can't pass the road, but the floodwaters deteriorate the concrete. So all of a sudden now you're investing all this money in road development, and you're just going to have to do it again because you haven't built to the proper standards. So there is this once in a generation spend from the Biden administration, the $1.2 trillion that you referenced, that there is some concern that we're building a lot of the infrastructure out of that project, the Infrastructure Improvement and Jobs Act, that is not going to be to the standard that needs to be built to protect the communities. Essentially, as it's built, it's either going to be out of date right away or it'll be out of date much sooner than we think it would be.
That's Jeremy Porter, head of climate implications research at the First Street Foundation. We thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Porter.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed talking about it.
As this program was being prepared, slow-moving torrential rainstorms, very similar to those that struck eastern Kentucky 1 year ago, were falling on the western side of the state, including the town of Mayfield, still making a long-term recovery from that violent tornado that killed 57 people in December of 2021. Now, people in Mayfield have been forced to flee to high ground to escape flooding. These events are referred to as 50-year, 100-year, or 1,000-year floods. As NPR's Rebecca Hersher tells us, the words officials use when they talk about flood risk can be misleading.
If you live in a flood-prone area, as tens of millions of Americans do, you've heard the words I'm talking about.
We are at a 1,000-year level.
Called 500-year rainfall.
100 years flood.
Is this a good phrase, 100-year flood?
I think it's highly confusing to people. It's based on probabilities.
Alice Hill studies disaster resilience.
Many people assume that if their area has experienced the 1 in 100-year flood, that means that for the next 99 years, they need not worry about flooding. So,
and that's not the case?
That's not the case.
So here's what a 100-year flood does mean. It means there's a 1% chance it will happen each year. If it happens this year, there's still a 1% chance it will happen next year.
As with a flip of a coin, if you flip heads twice in a row, that doesn't mean that you're going to get tails the next time. So you could have three very significant floods right in a row.
That kind of thing is happening more and more frequently. For example, North Carolina got hit with two really wet hurricanes in a row in 2018 and 2019. And that prompted then-Governor Roy Cooper to say this.
When you have two 500-year floods within 2 years of each other, it's pretty clear it's not a 500-year flood.
But that's not it. Both floods had a low probability of happening. But sometimes low probability things do happen. And Hill says the widespread confusion about basic flood probability is a big problem.
We are leading people to be unprepared.
It's not surprising that the 1 in 100-year language isn't helping people prepare for flooding. It was never meant to. The 100-year flood term was adopted by Congress back in the 1970s to describe who would be required to buy flood insurance. And researchers say there are better ways to communicate flood risk. Instead of talking about how likely a given flood is to happen each year, talk about how likely that flood is to happen over many years. For example, if there's a 1% chance of a flood happening each year, that means there's a 26% chance it will happen over the course of a 30-year mortgage. And if you live your whole life in a flood zone, you're more likely than not to experience a 100-year flood. Explaining flood probability that way helps people understand their risk over time. And the stakes are high when it comes to flood risk. In many parts of the country, flooding is getting more frequent and severe. Climate change is part of the problem. Warmer air can hold more moisture, which falls as more extreme rain. And in many places, development is also creating more runoff, all of which puts more people in harm's way, many of whom don't know they're at risk. Rebecca Hersher, NPR News.
With the increasing frequency and intensity of extreme weather events such as these floods, nature seems to be sending the message that we need to do much more to prepare. Some observations from Special Topics reporter Chris Begley. We apologize for the quality. Chris is on an archaeological dive in Sicily.
A year has passed since the flood, the big one, of July 2022. Looking back on a year of recovery, the first thing that strikes me is how much remains just as it was, in the same place it was left by the water. The same shattered house still sits right where it washed up against another one, and those cars haven't moved at all. I drove past the same bicycle, little, a child's, in the same place by the road where I saw it a couple of days after the flood. Sometimes I think about why it hasn't moved. Usually, I try not to. You can drive for miles down some of these roads and not see a soul. In other places, a lot has happened. Some places have rebuilt entirely. Others are on their way. I imagine that it depends on the resources folks could access or what they had before the flood. Of course, what resources you can get and what you had are related. I don't have any data yet, but it seems a lot of people left and are not coming back. That's been happening for some time, and it's surely worse now than it was before. I say worse because, for those I've heard from, it seems to be a last resort, something people wouldn't do if they had a better choice. Reflecting on all of this, I'm tempted to comment on how folks are strong and resilient, but I know they're sick and tired of being strong and resilient. Describing a group of people that way sure sounds like another way of saying that lots of unfortunate things happen to them. Strong and resilient, sure, but it would be nice to have the luxury of not being that way sometimes. What is different a year later is the way we talk about it all. Moving up out of the floodplain is a topic we hear a lot about. We talk about changing infrastructure. We talk about 100 or 1,000 year floods and how the old calculations are no good anymore. Climate change is in every serious conversation about what to do next. Maybe folks have had it with playing political games with something like that. When something like the flood makes it obvious, you better get it right. Is any of that progress? Yes, I think it is. How we talk about things sets the parameters for our imagination, for our creativity, for what we think is possible. Talk is cheap, but it has to happen before we find and embrace a solution or even an understanding of what happened. I'm not sure we have good solutions yet to the issues that the flood laid bare. At the very least, we're talking.
Special Topics reporter Chris Begley. Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Tom Martin, senior editor, writer, producer, and host. Mike Savage, executive producer. Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director. Chris Begley, special topics reporter. We're online at eswek.org, where you can check out the Eastern Standard archives, our series, our partners, and more. And you can sign up for our weekly e-newsletter. You can also find Eastern Standard online at weku.org, on the WEKU app, and anywhere you get podcasts, including Apple and Spotify. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. I'm Crystal Jones, in for Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to this episode of Rise, an Eastern Standard documentary series on WEKU.